And then, he could beat anybody. A lot of kung fu movies have this idea of the philosophy trumping the physical. It's a misunderstanding of Musashi, that if you adopt that proper philosophy and be like water or fear nothing, you don't need to practice 10 hours a day for 15 years. It's something that kung fu movies with their trampolines and deafening punch noises pushed on the world, and it's attractive. Everybody loves a shortcut. Plus, it makes a good movie narrative. A clueless hero gets beat up, studies for a few months, has a deep philosophical revelation, and emerges as a genuine badass. That's all bullshit. As Miletich says, you have to take a lot of beatings. Everyone I talked to, everyone I read, studied their own art obsessively. And all the Zen writing repeated this sentiment. Much patience, much heartbreaking practice is needed, just as in archery. But once this practice has led to the goal, the last trace of self-regard vanishes in sheer purposelessness. From Zen in the Art of Archery. Musashi says, you must practice this about every other sentence. A lifetime of study is not enough. Josh Waitzkin spoke about Marcelo Garcia rolling with the most beautiful chi he'd ever seen. Now, Marcelo doesn't study Tai Chi, and yet he rolls with it, because his level of mastery is so far advanced that he has internalized those concepts. He plays his game. It's like the great boxers who can uncoil like springs and hit harder than men three times their weight. They haven't studied anything but boxing, but their level of mastery is so high, they intuitively do those things that Musashi talks about. There are no shortcuts, but a lifetime of study. There are no easy ways, but obsession. But during that journey, that lifetime of study, one can recognize and feel these roots to the zone or the void. It's part of mastery. You can't start there, but you need to end up there. Athletes who learn to be confident, focus their attention on the task at hand, control their anxiety, and have appropriate and challenging goals may experience flow and peak performance more often, says the textbook. There's an often quoted Zen saying, enlightenment is an accident, but you can have more accidents. Zen koans, those odd little stories, are in some ways about that. Cutting you loose from your reasoning brain, the part filled with conscious thought and narration, tied up in the past and future and too slow to be useful in a fight. The koans don't make sense on purpose. Those Zen masters are trying to get you away from your prefrontal cognitive reasoning brain into the mysteries of the emotional and intuitive side. The wiser side, the big picture side. Dan Gable throwing apples was a version of the Zen koan. He's teaching you a lesson, but first, you have to come to the understanding on your own. What was the lesson? The same lesson Teddy Atlas was talking about when he said, at a certain point, if he's going to get to the top of the boxing profession, a fighter has to learn the difference between a truth and a lie. The lie is thinking that submission is an acceptable option. The truth is that if you give up, afterward, you'll realize that any of those punches that you thought you couldn't deal with, or those rough moments you didn't think you would make it through, were just moments. Pain is an illusion. Zen in the Art of Archery was written by a German, Eugen Herigel, who spent many years in Japan learning the practice of Zen through the study of archery. He wrote, Zen is akin to pure introspective mysticism. Unless we enter into mystic experiences by direct participation, we remain outside, twist and turn as we may. This law allows no exceptions. Like all mysticism, Zen can only be understood by one who is himself a mystic and is therefore not tempted to gain by underhand methods what the mystical experience withholds from him. You've got to wonder a little bit at the translations from Japanese to German to English. But I started to understand the Zen koan, deliberate mysteriousness. So that's why the stories sound so magical and bullshitty, because they have to be. They have to be somewhat mysterious. And you need to take that on as a reader, internalize it. To explain it would defeat the purpose. The purpose? I can't tell you. That would destroy it. But in some ways, it's an embrace of mystery, at least in part. A strategy to help you move away from your tightly focused left brain. There's a reason that a lot of high-level jiu-jitsu guys smoke pot and roll. We can revisit that old discussion of where to look in a fight. At his eyes or at his body? At the T of his chest? Musashi talks about the dangers of looking to only one place, even the eyes, because it limits you. If one place is stared at, the enemy can deceive you. Instead, Musashi favors looking through the opponent. Your stare should be unfixed. I think only of making the hit. I have no preconceived notions of which target is the one to aim for. I let nature take its course and permit the spirit of the thing itself to express itself through me and make me the victor. It's important to remember what Musashi was talking about, cutting another man with a sword, a man who is trying to cut you. Those legendary blades were incredibly sharp, horribly dangerous, and the duels had no margin for error. Freddie Roach, the boxing trainer, told me, "Well, if you just stare at one thing, you're going to get killed. It's not realistic. As a fighter, I see a whole picture of the fighter in front of me. I know when his feet move. I know when his hands move. He faints. It's a general picture. If you're looking at his feet, he's going to fucking kill you. I don't care what you say." And then he laughed his dry, raspy laugh. "You don't think about it," he continued. "You react and explode, and it's automatic. I can't say I'm going to land 1-2 of a 4-punch combination and realistically mean it. I won't land all 4 shots, but one punch will develop the next, and you don't know what that first punch developed until you're there. You become so accustomed to reacting to what your opponent does with that move that now it comes natural. You don't have to think about it. Feel for it." You can see that Freddy and Musashi are saying the same thing. And again, there are no shortcuts or mysteries. These abilities come only with endless practice. Once you've devoted a lifetime to study, then the important thing is to get out of your own way and not screw yourself up by thinking. Herigel describes the Zen experience, and it sounds just like being in the zone. The soul is brought to the point where it vibrates of itself in itself. A serene pulsation, which can be heightened into the feeling, otherwise experienced only in rare dreams, of extraordinary lightness, and the rapturous certainty of being able to summon up energies in any direction, to intensify or to release tensions graded to a nicety. This state, in which nothing definite is thought, planned, striven for, desired or expected, which aims in no particular direction and yet knows itself capable alike of the possible and the impossible. So unswerving is its power. This state, which is at bottom purposeless and egoless, can work its inexhaustible power because it is free. Although the realization of similarities between the zone and Zen was a revelation to me, the ideas had been floating around for years. Andrew Cooper wrote an interesting book called Playing in the Zone, and he wrote, from a far deeper Zen perspective, about the overlap between Zen and the zone. When I asked Greg Jackson to read this, he called me later to say with typical humility, "I must not have explained myself very well, because that's what I was talking about." Greg is way too nice a guy to ever say, "Duh." I came across a clip of Dr. Michael Larden talking about the old samurai and the similarities between Mushin No Shin, Musashi's The Mind of No Mind, and the zone experience. Dr. Larden is a celebrity sports psychiatrist, writing books, doing TV shows, and working with all sorts of top athletes, Olympians, pro golfers including David Duval, all kinds. But he's no empty suit. He's thoroughly accredited, a serious scientist and doctor, and a man with boundless enthusiasm and interest. There's a reason all these top-level professional golfers come to him. Dr. Larden's personal history drew me like a beacon. He'd been one of the best 16-year-old ping-pong players in the nation, and had been sent to Japan to train in 1976. He told me the story over the phone, one of those stories he uses all the time, to good effect. "I was training with a world champion at Senshu University outside of Tokyo, where we worked alongside martial artists. So I was exposed to a lot of the traditional martial arts, peripherally. There was this huge language barrier, but observationally, I would watch these martial artists do amazing things. I was fascinated with the idea of how they were training their brains and what transfer of energy it allowed them to do. They were doing so much with mental focus. One of them even told me, "You must leave no trace of yourself." One can imagine the impact that might have on a 16-year-old boy far from home. In table tennis, you generate potential energy into kinetic. The ball comes out at 90 miles per hour and hits the table. Spin takes hold on the bounce, and the ball shoots out at 100 miles per hour or more in any direction. And you have to touch just the top of the ball. If it hits your racket straight up, you can never control it. At Colorado Springs, the Olympic Center, a few years ago, they tested reaction times of all the Olympic athletes, and the table tennis players had the fastest time. No surprise. It's an 8-foot table, and the ball is moving at 100 miles per hour. It necessitates completely instinctual play. If you used your cognition at all and thought about the shot, you couldn't hang. At this young age, Lardon had his first real experience with the zone. Back in the United States at the USTTA Junior Championship match at Caesars Palace in Vegas. I had been meditating, and I fell into this dreamy zone. The ball was moving in slow motion. I could do anything I wanted. I was winning everything. Then a friend started talking, and he said things like, "This is going to be a huge upset." And as soon as he said it, it was over. I fell out of the zone and lost the next 3 games in the championship. Michael had gone on to Stanford and then medical school, all the while building his research around the zone state. In the early 1990s, I tried to look at the action of the brain, what was happening neurologically. Sports psychology doesn't do that too much. My hypothesis was that the top athletes were just getting more efficient at processing signals. We studied top Olympians, triathletes, John McEnroe, all these guys who talked about time slowing down. As the technology for testing got better, things got more interesting. Michael was working with the Scripps Research Institute doing EEG testing on athletes playing a video game they designed. There's a thing called the P300, a positive wave at 300 milliseconds when stimulus hits the brain. Everyone has it. When a sound enters your ear, you can watch it on the EEG. After a mathematical manipulation making an event-related brain potential, or ERP. Everyone's brain does it, almost like a heartbeat on the EKG. Think of that little squiggly jag, beeping on the monitor in hospital TV shows. It's the reaction time of electrical activity in the brain. People with dementia have it at 350 milliseconds, slower than normal. Our hypothesis was that top athletes would have a faster time, that electric signals would move faster in their brains, Dr. Lardon said. The philosophy of the study comes from David Spiegel at Stanford, one of my heroes, a brilliant guy whose father, Herbert, was a scientific leader in hypnosis. David put people, hooked to an EEG, in a hypnotic trance, and then had 2 paradigms. One, he had them imagine there was a screen that blocked out a light that was being shot at them. What Spiegel found was that when people imagined this screen, there was a reduction in the P300 amplitude, as if the light was really being reduced. Then he flipped it and had them imagine a giant magnifying glass that strengthened the light coming into their eyeballs, and there was an enhancement of the P300. I thought this was a landmark study, because what it tells you is that states of consciousness actually change the way you biologically process stimuli. So you think, hey, the baseball is coming, and it is what it is. A ball moving 95 miles per hour, there's nothing I can do about it. But there is something you can do about it. You can affect the way you process it. Ted Williams, one of baseball's greatest hitters, had always talked about how he could see the baseball hit the bat and count the stitches. That was what Sheldahl was referring to. In Blink, Malcolm Gladwell writes of a tennis coach who had studied these things and found that in the final 5 feet of a tennis ball's flight toward a player, the ball is far too close and moving much too fast to be seen. The event happens in 3 milliseconds, far, far too short a time for the human eye to see it. But Ted thought he could. To him, it was real. And just because it is physically impossible, does that mean Ted was imagining it? I think the short answer is no. If everything else speeds up, then time slows down. Dr. Larden continued, "In doing this testing, we thought we were going to see a faster P300 from top athletes, but we didn't see that. What we saw instead was another wave, called the N50, a negative potential at 50 milliseconds that everybody has. But in great athletes, that potential came early, with more amplitude. So it wasn't the cortical process that was different. It was the priming pathway. It was as if they were picking it up earlier." Michael talked about an insight he had, in terms of explaining this. His older brother had been deeply involved in very fancy stereos when they were growing up in New York. He was into the high-end stuff, the 20 grand stereos. The best stereos reproduced sound by making the circuit as fast as possible. Things we thought were cool, like equalizers, actually interrupted the flow, and you lost depth of field, or lost the imaging quality of a great stereo. All those conductors with gold inlay were to make circuits as fast as possible. More beautiful was faster. I was John McEnroe's courtside guest, watching him and Andre Agassi, and I could just feel how they were both picking the ball up much quicker than you or I. There have been plenty of studies that show that experts are much more efficient than amateurs at performing the same tasks. Their brains are more efficient and use less energy, giving you more energy to deal with anything outside of the practice task. Of course, what defines expertise? 10 years of study or more. That same old line. Dr. Larden continued to an interesting further hypothesis. In your brain, there are these bands, alpha, beta, and then the gamma. They're brain waves, electrical activity. Now, in schizophrenics, the gamma band is disrupted. They have trouble processing information. If you and I are talking, and you had a dream last night, you can differentiate between the two. For schizophrenics, that boundary is knocked down. I have a little buzz right now on my telephone. A schizophrenic wouldn't be able to listen to you over that little buzz. There's something called a Kanitsa image. Like drawings by Escher, they fool you visually. First you see one thing, then, as you look longer, you see another thing in the negative space. They discovered during studies on composers, at the moment of recognition of the other thing, the gamma band reveals itself in the brain. What's thought now is that the gamma band has to do with cortical synchronicity. When the gamma band comes, then the motor and sensory parts are firing as one, like an in-tune engine. I thought then about the special forces guys training with that M-wave monitor that showed coherence between brainwaves and breathing, again, like an in-tune engine. And I instantly started to think about all the pattern recognition. How a lot of guys in a fight would see patterns in an opponent and start cracking him up inside his own pattern. It kind of made sense in a grand cosmic scheme of things, feeling and finding patterns without thinking about them. So right now, I'm involved with Scripps and we're testing this further, trying to correlate the gamma band and the zone experience. I feel like it's the closest we've ever been to understanding what's going on. Dr. Larden told me an interesting story about watching a professional actress unwinding after an evening's performance. I watched her backstage, and for 20 minutes she was coming out of this hypnotic state. It reminded me of the zone. I've seen it so many times in interviews with athletes after a great performance. They're in this trance, this sort of egoless place. They often don't have much to say. It seems Sheldahl was right positing that to ask artists or athletes about their time in the zone would get you scandalously dopey answers. Dr. Larden talked about how he'd seen it in so many professional golfers who asked him for help. It was usually after they had done well and won a major tournament, and fame was upon them. Suddenly, the ego gets involved, and when it does, I bet there's no gamma band happening. Now, we don't know where ego lies, neuroanatomically, but my theory is that it interferes with your circuitry, like a stereo. The ego is treble and bass. You lengthen the circuit, and now it's not so fast or efficient. Dr. Larden had been working with a fighter and was very confused by the world of fighting, the intrusive promoters who were asking him to violate doctor-patient confidentiality. He mused, The way that fighters are propped up in the media is basically antithetical to the parameters of the zone, of no mind. They have to badmouth each other, threaten to rip his heart out. I could almost hear him shaking his head. It was a long way from the PGA Tour. I thought about Frank Shamrock's shit-talking, specifically designed to keep you out of the zone. During the recent dream fight between Manny Pacquiao and Oscar De La Hoya, head games and mental strategies were in play. Freddie Roach made a big stink, a few days before the fight, about the way Oscar tapes his hands, rolling the tape to create extra knuckles. He took it to the commission and got a partial ruling. And like in the old days, he got to go watch Oscar get his hands taped pre-fight, which is how it used to be done. A trustworthy man from your camp would be in the opponent's locker room and watch him tape and glove up, making sure he wasn't putting a horseshoe in his glove. Freddie said, "I had a real point, but if you can mentally fuck with a guy on the day of the fight, then you're doing your job. It's a mental game. Look what Hopkins did to Trinidad. They say it never got to Oscar, but I know it did." He laughs his dry laugh. Oscar reads the internet. And Oscar's mental flaws were on display like never before, constantly casting about for a new trainer, someone to tell him what to do. And coming into the fight lighter than Pacquiao was surely a sign of machismo gone wrong. Manny, deeply in the zone, shut Oscar out and beat him up worse than anyone in his career. He fought perfectly and seemed unhittable, a work of art. Maybe it wasn't what art can tell us about fighting. Maybe it was what fighting and sports can tell us about art. Art a sporting event? Was that what David Sally was telling me? Csikszentmihalyi had begun his research talking about the flow with composers and poets, not athletes. He talked about looking for places to find ecstasy, sports arenas and temples under the same roof. For my very first real fighting experience in Thailand, I saw that the best fighters were the most humble. But, much like jiu-jitsu, you start to see it's a chicken-or-the-egg question. Is it that great fighters lose their ego? Or is it that you cannot become great unless you lose your ego? Your ego keeps you out of the zone? Guys who can naturally control big egos do better? You have to live through it, Dr. Lardon said. The 18th hole at the PGA West is all water up the left. And if you hit it there, you don't have a job. When you're not at peace with that, then you're in trouble. But what about the huge egos of guys like Michael Jordan, who needed control over the court? Or Kobe Bryant? Their monstrous egos obviously don't keep them out of the zone. Jordan's the defining athlete of this concept. I would imagine it's because they can compartmentalize and, in the moment, remove any trace of self-consciousness from what they do. They control it, like they control everything else. And they're at peace with it, with taking the pressure shot. They're at peace with failure or success. As Sheldahl wrote, they take an impersonal joy in what they do. They see themselves from the outside, as impersonal constructs, which may lead to the oft-ridiculed referencing themselves in the third person. Andre Ward told me, concerning his faith, "My faith and understanding is that God placed me here for a reason. He has work for me to do. That encourages me and keeps me going. I've said this before, and so does Verge, as a professional, that without God, I wouldn't be in this business. I just wouldn't." Andre paused. "God has me here for a reason. He's in control of everything, and his will come to pass. My job is to work hard. Give him all I have in preparation, and leave it to him. It's everything, the centerpiece, the cornerstone of my career. He's brought me this far. He's not going to leave me high and dry. He won't pull the rug from under me. There's work to be done." I could hear in his voice two things: a way to avoid ego, and a way to avoid fear. His faith was perfect for fitting him into the zone. I thought of Laborio, of the importance of acceptance, of Manny Pacquiao, almost a kind of fatalism. The mentality that accepted the possibility of the worst, with a deeper understanding and without fear, because fear would keep you from attaining the no mind. What does all this mean, in a practical sense? You have to be simple, uncomplicated, pure, just to have a shot at falling into that zone state. And of course, you need your 10,000 hours, too. Jordan and Kobe worked harder in the gym than everyone else. You can't just stay super relaxed, talk a bunch of shit to keep your opponent out of the zone, or have the deep philosophical revelation and win the fight, the Karate Kid trap. You need to have outworked him in the gym. The more you immerse yourself in the subject, the deeper you go, the closer you come. There's no secret to the zone, the void. It comes only after mastery. The Long Koan. Paul Theroux, the great travel writer and novelist, calls it the awkward question when an innocent adventurer, back from some hellhole, gets asked, why, at a cocktail party or on the street? Fighters and adventurers will go to great lengths to avoid answering. Dr. Horton replies, why not? Something I used with mixed results for years. Something I'd probably still be saying if I hadn't taken the money to write the first book. Theroux stuck it to Gerard Debouville about rowing a small boat across the Pacific in 1993 with enormous personal risk. Gerard resisted the question, and then Theroux recounts the answer. Only an animal does useful things, he said at last after a long silence. An animal gets food, finds a place to sleep, tries to keep comfortable. But I wanted to do something that was not useful, not like an animal at all. Something only a human being would do. The art of it, he was saying. Such an effort was as much aesthetic as athletic. And that the greatest travel always contains within it the seeds of a spiritual quest. Or else, what's the point? The why of fighting is the elephant in the room. And I would be remiss if I didn't take a stab at it in a book about the mental side of fighting. Any attempt to understand why begins with the nature of the beast, with understanding what fighting is. Paul Lazenby wrote an article about the Japanese fighter Masakatsu Funaki. This is the same Funaki that Frank Shamrock fought and who trained Ken. Now, he was fighting long past his prime and getting beat up. The same old story. Paul had also lost to Funaki and was aware of Funaki's legend. He'd started the first ever pro wrestling group with no preordained finishes, called Pancrase, in 1993, the year the UFC started in the United States. Paul's article was about the debt he felt was owed to Funaki. Funaki had recently fought as a shadow of his former self, just an old man getting pounded on. Paul was disgusted by some disrespect he overheard from fighters who couldn't remember what Funaki had been in his prime. As Paul noted, it becomes painfully clear that the Herculean task of laying the groundwork for the sport that we know and love has taken more from Funaki than he could ever recover. I had the same feelings when I listened to Thomas Hearns talk about making a comeback, with his mouth full of cotton, at the age of 46. Boxing writers, that sagacious lot, implored him not to fight. They didn't want to see him lose to a no-talent club fighter. A guy who couldn't carry Hearns' jockstrap when he was in his prime might get to say he beat Tommy Hearns. Why would Tommy want to fight again? But the pundits, fans, and outsiders weren't walking in his shoes. Hearns had lost some of his biggest fights, and the shadows couldn't let him go. I understood his need and felt like we owed him something. What is the debt we owe great fighters? Is it owed them because of what they've shown us about courage and resiliency? Is it about what they have given to inspire us? The insight into the human heart and mind, the simple thrills. Why is there such reverential tragedy to Muhammad Ali, and now to Evander Holyfield? Why do I find such compassion and even love in my heart when I listen to Gabriel Ruelas? The price you pay as a fighter is real. A throwback to the old days. The days when human life wasn't so precious. Throughout the past 3 or 4 centuries, a human life has become increasingly valued. But this is an exception, not the norm of human history. Prize fighting's roots lie in a time when life was cheap. The world has changed, and prize fighting has continued through it, undergoing paradoxical changes. The paradox of fighting lies in something Gabriel Ruelas, who knows better than most, asked me. How safe can you make a sport that is about hurting people? Carlo Rotella wrote in his book, Cut Time, boxers hurt each other on purpose, a simple truth with unsimple consequences. In boxing, hurt is what people do to each other, an intimate social act, a pessimistically stripped-to-the-bone rendition of life as it is lived outside the ring. Hurting each other is all there can be between two boxers in an honest bout. You, the fighter, you are paying a price. Fighters give us something irreplaceable. Even the opponents, the bums, deserve to be respected for that. They can lose their wits, their intellect, their wisdom, everything a man has. Joe Frazier said, "Boxing is the only sport you get your brain shook, your money took, and your name in the Undertaker book." There is an element of tragedy in fighting, even in victory. We feel gratitude to fighters because we owe them for our joy and excitement, for showing us the truth of courage. There is acting in a prize fight, and play acting in image. But there is also something very real happening, something that can't be faked. Even an expertly worked, fake match isn't as exciting or enlightening as a great fight. Fighting is tragic, even in victory. But that doesn't mean it isn't worthwhile. Most of us in the first world live in the safe society, as John Wertheim wrote, where aggression has become a bad word, and testosterone a banned substance. Danger is something to be avoided, something to be neutered. We have discovered that some things are worth the price. Fighters and those who train, who take shots to the head, they know in their hearts it can be costly. But there are reasons to fight and reasons to feel alive. There are prices worth paying. Rotella again in cut time. Hurt changes you. Hurt carries meaning. It can educate you. But it can also rob you of your capacity to learn or feel, or even to think. A fighter who gets hit too often can descend into dementia pugilistica. A heavy hitter can go blood simple. A jaded spectator can fall entirely out of the habit of compassion. The meaning can drain out of hurt, leaving only the nakedness of it. We have to be on guard to make sure that we never drain the meaning from our hurt. It requires vigilance and understanding, particularly in fight writers, those who study so much and watch so much, without personal investment, with a connoisseur's eye. The good fight writers and TV commentators never lose sight entirely of what this is all about. They never lose respect for the men fighting. The same can be said for any fan. Never lose sight of what is happening when you cheer a bloody war. Professional fighting is an awkward, uneasy thing. It falls in a strange place in society. It's entertainment, yet it serves the participants and the audience with an intrinsic need, scratches a primal itch. It's the manufacture of life and death situations for public consumption. The promoters and participants have to walk the line of entertainment and performance. There is some moral corrosion that happens, for the fans, for the fighters, for the promoters, if they walk that line too fine. One of the more interesting problems any trainer has to deal with is the difficulty of reconciling winning and entertaining. Mark Delagrotti was the first guy I really talked to about it in Boston. He has learned the lessons the hard way. I remember when Jorge Rivera fought Dennis Hallman, and Jorge survived and ground out a win. I kept telling Jorge, "Be careful, he's still dangerous." When I ran into the UFC matchmaker, Joe Silva, later, he was pissed off. He said, "That fight sucked. Jorge could have knocked him out." I thought he was kidding, but he wasn't. And I had to learn the same lesson with Patrick Cody. I realized that the fight's gotta be exciting, or else everyone loses. We turn this back into boxing. You have to fight strategically to win, but not overcautious, because you're an entertainer. If people are turning off the TV, where are we going? Nobody makes money. Now the fighters themselves, the referees are slowly changing the formats. The stand-ups are getting faster and faster. It's not always about winning. It's about putting on a show, too. The history of modern prize fighting traces back to the 1700s and James Figg's School of Arms and Self-Defense in England. It was an era of near-constant warfare, unbreakable class divisions, and personal violence. Europe was emerging from medieval darkness and practices such as dueling were gradually being outlawed because they were costing the crown its best officers. Gentlemen of the fancy, the gaming fans who went to prize fights, bull and bear baitings, rattings and so forth, began to get involved in actually training and fighting. Their lives had value as members of the aristocracy. Gentlemen couldn't fight bare-fisted, like common ruffians. The life of the fighter began to acquire a different value, and the rules began to trickle in, culminating with the 1867 Marquess of Queensberry rules. In boxing, because of its long professional history, performance and entertainment have become very close. The fans and aficionados, well-versed in fine detail, want to see the very best in boxing compete, even if they never get a knockout. Skilled defensive work is appreciated. Andre Ward, criticized for being protected, is picking his fights. He's trying to win a losing game, make a career in boxing without getting his brain shook or his money took. He'll take his risks when he has to. He'll fight for titles against the tough guys when the money is there, but he won't brawl for our thrill. And he is respected for it by anyone who knows anything. MMA, with a dominance of one single promotion, the UFC, and an extremely varied fan base in terms of education and the nuances of the sport, features a bigger dichotomy between entertainment and winning. It's something that promoters, fighters, and trainers struggle with. For the promoter, fighting is about asses and seats. For the top fighters, it's about winning and taking as little damage as possible while inflicting the most. There are extremely boring ways to win in MMA, and the UFC has tried to eliminate those, either directly through rule changes, like gloves and stand-ups, or indirectly, letting fighters who win boring go. The strategy works. Exciting slugfests draw in raw fans. But fighters in modern MMA have an incredible line to walk, a line of self-sacrifice and damage, where it's better to lose in an exciting fashion than to win. Promoters will actually tell that to the fighters. No one finds it disheartening. Basically, take damage for our entertainment. Bleed for us. Wrestlers and ground fighters increasingly stand and brawl, hoping to be fan favorites, or for the extra cash of a fight of the night prize. The UFC uses images of a gladiator in its promotional videos, making the point that these are the modern-day versions. Of course, no one fights to the death. Still, death is a part of what they are doing. While boxing has evolved to allow for top fighters to reap the rewards, the UFC is not. Fighter payouts are still an egregiously small portion of total profits. I hope MMA continues to grow, and the fighters can be the ones making the money from people paying to see them fight. It's a simple thing. If the UFC is doing the numbers it claims to be doing, then someone is getting very rich, and it's not the fighters. Clara De La Torre is a professional boxer in New Mexico and a great friend of mine. And when she went on a 6-fight losing streak, she said the feeling was like surfing the apocalypse. She was in danger of turning into an opponent, even though some of her losses had been obvious robberies by hometown judges. But she was still game. Clara is educated, finished college, had been a firefighter who managed helicopters and a yoga instructor. Boxing gave her things that nothing else did. What things, you ask? Ah. A lot of the best guys in the world will claim fighting is merely a sport, but that is just the way they see it. In order to control fear, they take emotion out of the fight. But a fight is personal. It can't help itself. It's about you and me. Randy Couture is not just a competitor, as the pundits are fond of saying. He's a sportsman and a gentleman, but he's also a rough dude who plays rough and loves, in the fiber of his being, to break tough guys. It satisfies him in a way that nothing else does. If it didn't, he'd be coaching wrestling at OSU. There are mysteries left in the world, especially when it comes to the arena of tough guys. Man on Wire is a wonderful documentary about the Frenchman Philippe Petit, who walked a tightrope between the Twin Towers in New York City and was arrested after doing it. The reporters kept shoving microphones in his face, asking, "Why do you do it? Why?" He laughed, surprised, and answered simply in his light voice, his heavy French accent, "There is no why." He found the media's need to know why melancholy, bitterly amusing. He regretted that you needed to ask. On The Daily Show, Jon Stewart asked me why I went to Thailand to fight, and I answered, "It seems funny now, but at the time it seemed normal." You'd think I would have prepared a better answer for that one, my why. When I spoke to the Army psychologists at Fort Bragg, I asked about teaching mental toughness, if that was part of the Special Forces training. The answer was an amused no. The men who were there had learned it already, somewhere else. They battled their way through training on their own. Their mental toughness skills had to be proved before they even got to this point, not taught to them now. It made me think of Tom Brands, how he talked about the mysteries of tough guys, what makes them tick, and of an old friend in the dogfighting business who said, "The right one is the right one," when asked about picking a dog to train and cultivate. There is no way of knowing, but you try and hope that you got the right one. Only the result is the final proof. Fighting plays to the instinctual nihilism in some men, the part that, when faced with impossible odds or certain destruction, says fuck it and charges. It's not something easily understood, and here I think the sexes often diverge. Not many women can be satisfied with fuck it as a real reason, but most men will understand it. Fyodor Dostoevsky, the great Russian novelist, understood the value of such sentiment. He wrote in Notes from the Underground, "What is to be done with the millions of facts that bear witness that men, consciously, that is, fully understanding their real interests, have left them in the background and have rushed headlong on another path, to meet peril and danger, compelled to this course by nobody and by nothing, but, as it were, simply disliking the beaten track, and have obstinately, willfully, struck out another, difficult, absurd way, seeking it almost in the darkness? And what if it happens that a man's advantage, sometimes, not only may, but even must, consist in his desiring in certain cases what is harmful to himself? We choose things that are against our own best interests, because the freedom to make that choice is more important than those interests. How many times do you hear fighters say, 'I don't care who they put in front of me, I'll fight anyone'? Therein lies the appeal. Fighters will say, 'I'm willing to die in the ring,' and they are admired for it, for the commitment. In fact, that's an absurd statement. You're willing to die, in a fight with some guy you don't really know, for money, to entertain people? What is important is the principle of the thing. The fighter is saying he's willing to die rather than be dominated. He's valuing his free will over his life, something that we all admire. Fighting at its center is about making someone do what they don't want to do, enforcing your will. We come to the fights to see that struggle as much as great technique. We want to see heart on display. We want a chance to see real courage, and it can be a costly show. When I wrote my first book, I had to do press, interviews and radio shows, things like that. I wasn't particularly good at it, but then my agent told me to start acting like a politician. Have some points you want to make, and make them regardless of what questions get asked. One of the things I picked was that fighting is about identity. You are forced to learn who you are. The research for this book has convinced me even more of that truth. All the talk of game plan seems to play to it. Josh Waitzkin said, "I think organic game plans work the best." And what he meant by organic was natural, natural to you. The game plan has to come from who you are. When Jong Sinan talked about being the wooden man, when he spoke of De La Hoya being the golden boy, he was talking about the duality of the game plan and the fighter. You come to resemble who you have to be. You have to fight like who you are. In other walks of life, maybe you can get away with pretending, but not in fighting. You have to honor your true nature. Fighting forces honesty down your throat. You can and should deceive your opponent, but not yourself. It's why fighters are so forthcoming, although elusive, and trainers can see right through them. That journey of self-discovery is a major reason to why a lot of young men are drawn to the fight world. Greg Jackson said, almost in passing, I have guys here who are marginally functional. They wouldn't be respected anywhere else but in here. They work hard and get respect. FX Tool, the pen name for 20-year cutman Jerry Boyd, wrote in Rope Burns, the fight game isn't about being tough. It's about getting respect. One of Boyd's memorable characters is Danger Barch. So tragicomic in the movie Million Dollar Baby with his absurd refrain, I challenged the Motor City Cobra, Tommy Hearns. Danger is a familiar figure if you hang around the fight game. Every gym in the entire world has a nut job like that, some marginal character. It's a place where you can belong if you put in the work. Nobody fucks with the crazy people who come to the gym, as long as they work. As Henzo said, the least physically gifted can become champions with enough grit, or at least get respected. In Thailand, there was a badly crippled ex-fighter who was a human ring clock, hooting at the end of the rounds. He got respect, even though he could barely move. Freddie Roach's brother Pepper is a former drug addict. He's been in and out of jail. He'll laugh and show you his white power tattoos, bolts and swastikas, while he's giving fist bumps to all the black and Hispanic fighters that come through the door. Pepper's laugh is truly a joyous thing. He finds the world hilarious, but, even more so, himself and his place in it. He's told me some of the funniest stories I've ever heard, and he belongs in the gym, and not only because of his brother. Pepper isn't even close to the craziest cat that comes in there. When I spoke to Carlo Rotella about this issue over the phone, he said, one of the things that always impressed me about the fight world, people want to feel like things they do in their life are meaningful and important. Fateful. That was a word Carlo would come back to often. Fateful. People wanted to feel like the things they did mattered. He had written, the primacy of hurt supercharges even the smallest detail. It seems like the fight world is well set up to turn everything you do into something fateful and important. Every sit-up, staring at yourself in the mirror, every little detail of your day, whether you slept well, ate well, blinked or not, standing face to face with that guy is the most fateful. And important details matter in the epic that is your life. There is a whyness to that. Carlo laughed and continued, it helps explain why there is no money. Because you get paid in satisfaction. It's not just spectacle. Fighters and trainers get addicted to big fights meaning something. Same for fight fans and corners. Corner men in the gym spend hours watching people do the same old damn things they do all the time. Carlo thought a moment and then continued, talking about opponents, guys with losing records who keep fighting. A guy with a 13-27 record, is he there for the cheering? No. He thinks, I'm the guy who goes in there and mixes it up and doesn't get hurt, and this is my craft. I get through it. I'm a tough guy. This brings me to the final note of a fighter's mind. What fighting is for, personally. It's always there, in the room with fighters, but never discussed. Hard to understand. I talked to Pat Miletich a lot about it. Pat himself had plenty of fuel. An abusive father who died young of cancer, and a lot of tragedy, brothers dying, going to jail, committing suicide. There's some guys out there that are from normal families, that are still animals and smash people. But usually it helps if you've had a shitty life. If somebody's starving, then somebody else is getting their ass kicked. Many, many fighters come from damage. It is their why. I sometimes think of Rory and his friend who leaped to his death right in front of him. Rory's story, though unique, is by no means shocking. Most fighters are men who have come to the profession from fighting elsewhere, from fighting to feel good. After Ed's death, Rory went on a 2-year jag of street fighting, where he religiously went out Friday and Saturday nights and got in a fight every night. Which means, and he'll admit it, he was a raving asshole. But like all pro fighters, when they start fighting for money, they stop street fighting. They have nothing to prove to strangers on the street anymore. They have a sense of self-worth. They know what it is to be loved, to have responsibility. Their trainer needs them healthy. Fighting provides, eventually, what you are looking for. It could be anything. Tennis, chess, ultra running. But you will bring that same intensity and need and make it into a fight. It's a fight you want, however you manifest it. It can make you whole. People ask me, why fighting? And I tell them, there are a million different reasons, but they're all versions of the same reason. My attempt at a Zen koan. Why Clara Della Torre is still surfing the apocalypse. Boyd's line about respect is probably as close as anything. The gym, where a fighter truly lives and is made, takes everything from you. It will take your mental pain away. Struggling and fighting, you burn away all those hurtful emotions and emerge like an asteroid torched clean in the atmosphere and streaking toward the earth. The world is made of fire. I asked Freddie Roach. His Parkinson's, brought on by the wars in the ring, is descending on him without remorse, increasing the shake, and you can see him fold his arms sometimes to hide his trembling hands. I know you struggle with Parkinson's, I said hesitantly, looking for a way to proceed. I wanted to ask him about the price he was paying. I don't struggle, he laughed. For Freddie, it was worth it. Maybe for guys who didn't do as well, who didn't have the same ride. He shrugged and smiled. Freddie knows people outside of boxing want him to condemn it, to cry, look what it did to me. But Freddie has no regrets about boxing. It's mysterious to outsiders, but not to me. Why do we do anything? My first serious art teacher used to say, in his sad voice, we draw because we want to be loved. He was a dapper man, a quiet alcoholic with cold talent. Those kids from the broken place, from the howling wilderness of a childhood unloved, unvalued, they find something in fighting. They can take that love. The feeling of worth that the missing father never provided. You can force the issue, for one night, for one moment. Training is a recurring habit. You get drawn to the savage joy again and again. I heard Rory Markham say to an interviewer, I'm on the path, you know? And what he meant, perhaps without fully understanding it, was the path to enlightenment, to self-understanding. Fighting is a way for the unwise, the damaged, and the angry men and women to find wisdom. It makes you a better person. When Munenori wrote that the sword could be life-giving, he meant many things, one of which was that proper study of the sword would lead a student to the way. Why? There are a million different reasons, and there is one reason. Yours. This has been an Audible Studios production of The Fighter's Mind, Inside the Mental Game. Written by Sam Sheridan, performed by Nicholas Tikoski. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2010 by Sam Sheridan. Production copyright 2014 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.